Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Symmetry of Soul, in-depth synthesizing study of the Urantia book for able and willing students. Tonight, paper 55, section 2. It's our arc on purpose and destiny. Primitive man only thought when he was hungry, but advanced mortals hunger for more than their daily bread. Let's find out what life's like for those advanced mortals on those other spheres that someday our sphere will resemble as well. I'm Brad Garner. I'm so glad that you're here with us this evening live or in our archive at symmetryofsoul.org. With me tonight is Dr. Chris Halverson, our teacher, Kermit Anderson, and Justin Armstrong is filling in for Andrea Barnes, who is away this week. And, of course, you're here. Please call up the text of the Urantia book by paper or electronic means and take a seat with us for about 1% of your week. Good evening, Dr. Chris.
Good evening, Brad. Bravo on the intro. That was delightful. And hello to you, Justin. Thanks for stepping in. And hello, Kermit, and all those who are joining us. We are actually going to enjoy reading a section entitled Death and Translation tonight.
We are going to enjoy it very much, but we hope that the IRS isn't onto us too much because they usually like to be in there, death and taxes. We've replaced them with something a little bit higher. A little bit higher. We'll find out more about it. And Justin, good evening to you. How fare you, sir? So glad that you're here with us tonight.
I'm well, Brad. Good evening to you as well. And good evening, Dr. Chris and Kermit. I'm really excited about tonight's study.
Glad to have you with us, and I'm excited as well. Interesting, intriguing material, rife for visualization exercises as we hypothesize on what life is like on these worlds. And Kermit, good evening to you. Glad that you're here as always. I wonder how you're doing, and I wonder if you can fill us in on what we've been up to in the last week.
Well, greetings, Brad and Justin and Chris and everyone listening. Glad to be here tonight. And concerning last week, clarification of the duration of the Trinity Teacher Sons missions being 1,000 years for each mission led to a discussion of the Revelator's practice of placing details about a particular topic in different locations throughout the Revelation. This technique should encourage the serious student to develop a holistic approach to study. Comprehension of the fifth epical revelation as a revelation of truth requires the seeker to acquire a synthetic grasp of the coordination of essential knowledge. The precision of the transcendent coordination of linguistic composition across multiple authors has been demonstrated in many previous Symmetry of Soul broadcasts and never ceases to astound longtime students. The descriptions of the planetary epochs in paper 52 became increasingly abstract the further removed from the present day they became. As mentioned, how beyond our imagination is it to attempt to conceive of a world in which the least of the citizens thereon are far transcendent of the human Jesus in mind and body. Yet we all receive thought adjusters by grace, potentializing an eternal career and transcending the seemingly dire planetary problems of our time. The question was posed, how can one know if they have been born again? In paper 137, section 8, paragraph 8, Jesus teaches that the kingdom of heaven is entered with the faith and trusting dependence of a little child and characterized by striving for a nobility of character like that of the Father. Also recall the initial meeting of Nicodemus and Jesus in paper 146, section 6, where Jesus challenges Nicodemus with the idea of being born of the Spirit, recognizing the distinction between the things of the material world, the flesh, and the realm of the spirit. This spiritualization of mind brings with it the demands of divine law. Safely navigating the newfound freedom of sonship in harmony with liberty in law presents the kingdom believer with opportunities to cultivate discrimination and exercise self-control in being grown from spiritual childhood to a more mature state. Back to our arc on the progressive advancement of civilization and the progressive spiritualization of individuals, today's dilemma consists in the abundance of spirit-animated isms and a dearth of true religionists. Progressing civilization is sparked by the inner transformation of individuals and not by external reforms in the material world. We began our new paper 55, Spheres of Light and Life. Each successive planetary dispensation is imbued with specific purpose, culminating in the evolutionary utopia of light and life. This era continues indefinitely. There are 7 planetary stages of light and life. These stages correspond to the hierarchy of super universe administrative levels, beginning with the planetary stage and progressing up through the system, constellation, local universe, minor and major sectors, and finally the super universe stage. Planets may attain these stages independent of universe organization at large. Section 1 in paper 55, the Morontia Temple. The arrival on the planetary capital of the Morontia Temple signals the admission of such a world to the settled ages of light and life. Celebration of the inauguration of the age of light and life is a grand day. The paradise besoul sun is present to proclaim the promotion of the planetary prince to planetary sovereign and is accompanied by the system sovereign. The temple itself is constructed in situ according to plans brought by the Morontia power supervisors who, with the help of the master physical controllers, actually build the temple. The Morontia temple is of unparalleled beauty. It accommodates about 300,000 spectators. It is used for special planetary ceremonies, communications with the system sovereign, visualization ceremonies with spirit beings and silent cosmic contemplation. Activities such as worship, play, and receiving space broadcasts are not held here. Of some fascination for us is the Morontia Temple function as the assembly for witnessing thought adjuster fusion of fellow mortals. Symmetry of Soul speculated as to the nature of the fusion flash accompanying transition to the Morontia existence. Considering the energetics of fusion, the unraveling of molecular states of matter into automatons, we can imagine an energy release far in excess of nuclear events with which we are familiar. Such transactions as these give added meaning to casual phrases as going out in a blaze of glory. Prior to the advent of the Morontia Temple, mortal translations are accomplished in the planetary atmosphere. And that ends my summary, and now we're ready to continue more delving into death and translation.
When you put it that way, I can't wait. Thank you so much, Kermit. Thank you for the...
See,
the
I told you we'd have fun. We're laughing already.
That's right.
Hey, we're supposed to be all smiles when talking about this stuff, as we're going to read tonight. This is a supreme happiness, supreme joy. Yeah, but more about that in
exactly.
A little bit. Yeah. Quite a challenge they lay out to us. We'll get
actually,
to it.
Can't if you
wait.
Achieved it now, it would be more of a supreme happiness, whereas then it's very natural and it's a supreme joy. You want to make play off that little word challenge you were faced with there?
I was trying to remember my happiness versus joy discrimination, and you helped clarify. Thank you. Well, all right. Anything on anyone's mind, Justin? Anything occur to you listening to the show last week, or anything on your mind in particular?
You know, it's pretty silly, but I'm an Oregon Ducks fan, and when Kermit mentioned last week that you could get 3 Rose Bowls in the 300,000 stadium, I couldn't help but tick the laugh a little bit because the Ducks happened to play UCLA this last weekend, so that's all.
That's all.
And only in the small Rose Bowl.
Yeah. Yeah. Now I have the same thing. My alma mater for university seats about 100,000, and that I've been to several games there, so I have sort of a visual reference point. And sometimes I'll be like, oh, my entire city I live in could easily fit inside of Memorial Stadium. Oh, okay. Those frames of reference can be helpful, but 300,000 is kind of unfathomable. I don't think we have any stadiums that seat anything like that on Earth.
Wait till you see the stadium on Jerison.
That one's even more impressive. Yeah.
Yeah.
But so are our eyes. So, you know, lots of things.
Yes, your mindful vision, as it were. Yes.
You know, one thought, we talked so much about fusion, adjuster fusion last week. And, of course, it was some of the physics of it. Of course, how could it not with a physicist here? But one thought, it sort of stirred up a memory that I had. And I wonder, I'm probably not the only reader of the book and aspiring student of the book to have had this thought. Much younger in my life, as a teen, when I didn't have much of a grasp of the Urantia book, one of the things I did grasp was that you didn't have to die. And I had recently seen grandparents die. I had seen people grow old. And I remember as like age 15 or 16 saying, my goal in this life will be to fuse with my adjuster. And of course I withdraw that as the height of hubris now, but I just wanted to say, you know, if there are other people who are entertaining that idea or are declaring that idea, I mean, as a cosmic goal, that is very valid. That is consecration of your will in a very meaningful way. But I wonder if there's anything to say about a teenager saying they want to do it in this life, transparently, obviously, just trying to avoid the inconvenience and you know, just general all around lameness of death.
Well, Brad, I think I've mentioned in the past, either privately or on the broadcast, but I was able to find a bookmark that had been produced according to specifications of the Orvinton Urantia Society in Chicago. And their motto, of all things, was, we aim to fuse. So you're not alone in this.
Right.
Yes, and you might want to humbly step back from yourself and wonder if unconsciously that's driven by wanting to go out in that spectacular blaze of glory here while you're still in the flesh. Humbly, you should seek to fuse on the mansion worlds where it isn't this major energy event.
Atmospheric disturbance, yeah.
Because you have a mirage of body then, and it's just to like. And the not like, juxtaposition doesn't happen.
Yeah, I'm sure there were several reasons lurking under the surface. But yes, the look at me, look at me, look at me was certainly there too. Look how bright and shiny of an object I am. There's none brighter and shinier than fusion on a mortal origin sphere, I would imagine.
For a moment, I was like a supernova. I was more radiant than the sun.
Yeah. Aren't I clever? Yeah. Look at me.
Yes. But yeah, and we were speculating on, you know, how to think about all these issues of, you know, like we mentioned, they tell you that you've got this Urantia stadium so that you don't have this immediate issue with it. But even though it's it's not going to be vaporized, it's pretty hard to imagine that it isn't impacted. I mean, that it's not like an energy phenomenon like that, you know, going all the way down to the ultratonic level, you know, could possibly be completely transparent relative to the modified matter of Marantia.
Right.
But nonetheless, it's a very direct physics example of spiritual strength. And when we talk about bringing the influence of spirit down upon our mind to give our mind, which is, you know, not to be thought of as a substance at all, but much more of a fluid-like energy, to give that mind that those sort of fibers of integrity, quote unquote, spiritual strength. But in the case of Marantia substance, I mean, it's very literal, right? You've taken this, in one sense, fragile material structure, and you've woven spirit energy into it and literally given it spiritual strength in a, in a physics, physics sense. That, like I was pointing out, when you're talking about your, the literal Marantia object that is your soul, where the spirit fibers, if you will, that are woven into it, are of the adjuster, and the adjuster, when it fuses to it, I mean, the adjuster's innate integrity are, is literally threaded through your soul. I mean, it has, great spiritual strength in a literal sense. Much more so than the, the Marantia substance that the stadium's built out of.
Yeah, yeah.
Right. I mean, that doesn't have a, an adjuster, threaded through it. Right. It's just, if you will, ambient spirit energy that they've, they've woven into it. And so since we know so little about all this, one could speculate. It's like, well, maybe it sort of like rings a little bit or something when this blast goes off, or what would be the impact on it?
Maybe they have to repoint the mortar on the Marantia bricks every couple hundred years. I don't know. Who knows?
But it's just, we'll see it again as we start reading tonight. This differential between, your actual soul as a Marantia object, when you call it being made out of Marantia and, Marantia buildings being made out of Marantia, it all sounds the same, but, it's very different in a number of ways, in ways that none of the revelators, most of them, let's say it that way, most of the revelators don't, have access to an understanding of, right? Because they've never been to Ascendington. They can't partake of the secrets of Ascendington.
Chris, is part of that differential due to the fact that the adjuster is literally a deity fragment, whereas spirit as a substance is just one of the three aspects of the triune nature of reality, and so that difference of being a literal deity fragment has a quality to it that's somewhat transcendent of spirit as a substance.
There's that, but in terms of exactly how and of, and from what reservoir of material, it draws upon to make your soul. You see, there's just great mystery here. I mean, like we read, normally, you've got master physical controllers that are wielding the physical energies and Marantia power supervisors that, that can bring in the spirit energy, and they construct this out of these raw energies. But exactly how your soul is constructed, when you're not involving master physical controllers or Marantia power supervisors. That is very mysterious. You know, and we shouldn't be surprised if part of, you know, a corollary of that mystery is an integrity that transcends the run-of-the-mill Marantia stuff. It's just, you know, we can't say much more than those kind of rough speculations, you know, what sort of seems to suggest itself philosophically. But, you know, that's you know, it's useful to just kind of remind yourself of that, of just, you know, not only having an adjuster is something that an awful lot of beings in the universe don't have, and that in itself is a, you know, is an amazing gift and a deep mystery. But the product of the relationship between yourself and it is equally a mystery. In some ways, see, it's a, you know, that your soul is a super additive consequence of the relationship between you know, your spiritualized mind and the adjuster. So it's transcendent of the adjuster. Right, in a certain sense.
Well, in a certain sense, yeah.
See?
Right, it's the joint product of, yeah.
It's a super additive consequence, right? So, you know, in terms of what aspect of the adjuster is actually in a direct interplay with your spiritualized mind, right? And, you know, having this super additive consequence. You know, that aspect of the adjuster that's in direct interplay with you, your soul is above that, is transcendent of that. Now, that aspect of the adjuster that is within you.
Hmm.
You know, and if you take time out of you know, the picture, and take yourself all the way into the endless cycles of eternity, you know, what begins as this soul, you know, and eventually is fused and infused into that adjuster and whatnot, but it, you know, it is nonetheless in essence still there. You see, you know, throughout endless cycles of eternity, there will be an aspect of that that is transcendent of that purely existential fragment of the Father, you know, that was the nature of the adjuster when it began. The experiential is transcendent of the existential.
Right. Yeah, we've covered
that
here
before.
Existential is the nucleus, is the center, and then experiential radiates out. Other metaphors, yeah.
Right. So it's just, especially if you think of it more from the eternity viewpoint, it is a very profound fact that you're talking about when you're speaking of a soul. And no wonder there's, you know, on one of those worlds around the aisle, there are mysteries, you know, tied to it. Mysteries that will forever be off limits to many beings.
Justin, were you making a comment there?
Oh, I was just a quick question. I was going to throw out the idea of if it would be appropriate to, when you're talking about that super additive consequence and the contrast of experiential being transcendent of the existential nucleus, I was wondering if it would be appropriate then to think of Mother Deity in relationship to this soul that continues on in endless cycles of eternity, because I often associate sort of the mother with the experiential side of the equation.
It's not just your association, it is the fact. You know, Mother Deity is the overarching facet of experiential deity. You can think of all experiential deity and hence all of the experiential, all of experiential reality as within that context under that umbrella.
Okay.
You know, predicated on that fact.
So a statement like everything is being evolved in the finite that would be under that umbrella of the mother.
Right, the mother deity is the is the evolver. Right, that which evolves. Right, I mean evolution is driven by the functioning of mother deity. Sure, there's all kinds of, you know, other deity and various roles. You know, it's a complicated system, right? But, you know, to boil it down, right, I mean, that is the engine of evolution, the functioning of mother deity.
Right.
And, you know, it doesn't initiate that which gets evolved, but it evolves that which was initiated. Father deity is, you know, is what you take, go all the way back to for the source of initiation. But you know, the individuality of the parts, father deity, can't grow those parts because it does not embody the context. You know, that is the reference for how to grow things. You know, the father is not the whole, nor the individuality of the whole. You know, growth is a part taking on more wholeness. You know, beginning with the essence of the wholeness and working to the substance of the wholeness. That the father can't be a source for any of that. Right? That's the father separated himself from that so that there could be parts.
Right.
Yeah, you see. Yeah.
You know, not even existentially is he the whole. The Paradise Trinity is the whole. Neither of the, you know, none of the three, you know, infinite persons is existentially the whole.
That's the Paradise Trinity. And the Trinity teacher sons are here, come to us to teach us about the whole. They derive from the more from the whole. So I'm just tying it back to what we've been studying. It takes a long time to drill this stuff in.
Right. And justice administration, see, coming from those stationary sons of the Trinity.
Mm-hmm.
See, it's the context of the whole that makes that valid. It's not some arbitrary part, you know, exalting itself over other parts putting thumbs up, thumbs down on them. Right? It's a judgment of, does this part fit into the whole or not? I mean, if you don't fit into the whole, then you don't exist. That's just the way it is.
That's the way. That is the way. The Father's
yeah.
way.
Yeah.
Well, the Trinity's way. I don't know. They call it the
Trinity's
way.
Yeah, well, see, that's, you know, that whole, you know, like I said, it's a complex system to consider in full, you know, but you know, you existentially can say the fact of God the Father, the fact of God is the divine law. Okay, so but that's an existential statement. Exactly. How does that get implemented now and then directly engage the experiential? And that involves all these other details. But, you know, it no matter how complicated the details, bringing the Paradise Trinity and Mother Deity and all this, you know, sevenfold and whatnot, nonetheless, you know, at least to beginning recognition starts with, you know, there is the divine law, period. It exists. And nothing exists apart from it. It doesn't take any sophistication of philosophic construction of a cosmos to just have that born-again recognition of that fact. That you either put your liberty in the divine law or you can't exist. It's not that someone goes, well, you know, I just don't like the, you know, your attitude. I'm not going to let you exist. It's like, no, you can't exist.
Right.
It's all, you know, it either is in that context or it can't be. You know, and if we, you know, only had access to the eternity viewpoint, that's, you know, that's instantly an obvious fact. We get confused because from the time viewpoint, it appears that something apart from the divine law, no, it exists. What are you talking about? Okay, but it doesn't really exist. And the fact that it doesn't really exist will become apparent in time at some point. And to just kind of be reminded of the existential facts so that you don't get, you know, lost in that confusion of thinking that, you know, like Lucifer did. It's like, no, look, it. I don't have to submit to the divine law. And look, I'm still standing here. Yeah, well, that's an illusion, a time illusion.
Right, right.
You aren't really standing there.
Mercy illusion, yeah.
And I can go to eternity and check. It's like, nope, no Lucifer there. you know, he isn't really, you aren't really in existence when you aren't in perfect and complete conformity with the divine law. And you just have to keep that in mind as that fact is stretched out over time. Right? But as they say, that which cannot be sometimes spiritualized will eventually be disorganized. That which cannot be sometimes coordinated with cosmic reality will eventually be destroyed. Because it doesn't really exist. So of course it'll go away.
It reminds me even of a passage, not to go off topic here, but even in the geology papers, they refer to basically animals achieving cosmic unity. Those that do continue to exist, those that don't perish, in the species-wide sense. Like sharks apparently achieved cosmic unity some many millions of years ago because they're still here. You know, within their sphere, they achieved cosmic unity. This is just shot through everything, from sharks to finaliters.
Right. I mean, it's, you know, if something doesn't stem all the way back literally to eternity, the upholder, God the Mother, can't really uphold it. You know, so from a time, you know, as you go forward in time, eventually that species will not be there. Right? It has to have this reality underlying it. It can't be merely a temporal actuality and go on forever. It has to be an eternal reality to be truly enduring.
I have a really crude and oversimplified sort of visual of this concept of as above, so below, and the pattern. And I kind of think of the fractals, and I think of the Fibonacci sequence and how, you know, you have this basic pattern, 1 and 2 is 3, and 3 and 2 is 5, and you keep that pattern going. And when I think of the individuality of the whole, I think of this really high number up there, like this really giant representation of the pattern. But then when you go all the way down to the smallest, you know, the beginning stage, 1 plus 1 is 2, in terms of the individuality of the part, it's still in righteousness conforming to that pattern. It's manifesting that same quality of sort of cosmic harmony that exists on the large scale. So that's just a really simple visual that I keep in mind in terms of the unity of that process, the relationship between the individuality of the whole and the part.
Yeah, and you know, when all is said and done, that's a great analogy there. And when all is said and done, I mean, what's the difference between someone who's an actual religionist and someone who isn't? No matter you know, whether they call themselves a religionist or you go through all the motions or whatever. I mean, are they an actual religionist? You know, an actual religionist is someone who doesn't judge things ultimately by their temporal appearance, right? They've lifted things from time to eternity in their recognition, you know, and they know that if they aren't taking the divine law seriously, then they don't really exist, no matter how much, you know, someone can, you know, come up and hug them and shake their hand. They don't really exist in the eyes of God. Right? They take that seriously. And those who just cry, Lord, Lord, it's like, you know, no, from the standing point of the divine law, I will be compelled to say I never knew you. Right? Because you didn't take it seriously, right? That you have to really exist, not just be a temporal illusion. And obviously, as primitive, simple people, we start out with a limited, you know, conception of the divine law. But you know, we in our loyalty and our sincerity, we achieve the essence of conformity to it. And even if it's a long journey to get to the substance of it, we'll see that next week when we get to section 3. But it nonetheless, you recognize that that if you're really going to have a relationship with God the Father, you have to have God the Father likeness, right? And some sort of vacillating temporal self-defined fact is not like God.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter how much it cries, Lord, Lord. It doesn't have a real relationship to God. And the religionist knows that, you know, fundamentally, and takes it seriously and attempts, right, to live up to that, you know, as opposed to those who back into the Lucifer Manifesto and think, nah, you know, we're just, you know, we're self-existing, right? If I find our conduct pleasing, that's all that's required. It's like, no, the universe doesn't care. Right? The divine law doesn't care about what's pleasing to you or not or anything like that. It just is. Before you were, before time was, it was, and still is. Yeah. And just, that's, you know, so when we, you know, as we've talked about, this is the challenge when you tell people that God is love. For them to, it's very easy for immature creatures to, upon being told that, to unwittingly think, oh, so, really, I don't have to get serious about the divine law. God loves me. It's like, you know, what I was quoting before about disorganized and destroyed. I mean, that passage ends with, that which mercy cannot rehabilitate, justice will eventually annihilate. And just because God is love doesn't mean that sentence is not there.
Right. Right.
I mean, God can only love that which is real. You have to be real. He can't love something that's an illusion. He knows not illusions. He knows only reality. And that's what people can quickly forget. And when you begin to forget that, you end up thinking like Lucifer did. That, no, I think we just are self-existent and nothing to worry about. just do whatever pleases you. So, I mean, all of that, again, you know, we kind of talked about this, you know, this in the same mode at the beginning of last week's broadcast. But look at how it fits in, right? When you start talking about death and translation, and we're going to talk about fusion and these things. I mean, someone who isn't real can't fuse.
Right.
Doesn't matter how much they wish for it. Make bumper stickers about it, you know, or bookmarks, like you were saying, Kermit. It's like, no, you have to be a religionist, a real religionist, and beyond that, to fuse, in the same way that, you know, you can't get to a world enlightened life except where everyone's a religionist. You know, and there's an emergency on the planet right now because there's fewer and fewer religionists. Which means there's fewer and fewer nuclei for a personal living philosophy to form about, which means there's no source for, you know, the wisdom, insight, and foresight to keep civilization going.
It's been a humbling journey for me working with Symmetry of Soul these past years. You know, I've come a long way from that 15-year-old who figured he'd probably fuse in this life to recognizing that sometime in my 20s and maybe on into my 30s, like, I unwittingly became a part of the problem that is the emergency here. I fell into it. I'm not going to abscond myself of responsibility for it. I mean, I was swimming in the material currents of the day and going along because people told me, well, you should believe this and believe that. It helps you get a salary, helps you get a degree, and this is part of being an adult. And, well, I conformed. I went along with it. And you know, through our work here, I've said, huh, it appears that my path to fusion, God willing, of course, is going to be a path of recuperation and remediation, even from just, you know, a handful of years of unfortunate thinking and teaching that I picked up. But there it is. That's my path.
You know, if you're devoted to godless ideals, yes, God loves you absolutely, but he can only love you if you're real. And if you're devoted to godless ideals, to that degree, you're not real. You're not lovable. I mean, and, you know, when you're devoted to godless ideals, right, apart from the divine law, I mean, you know, not even spirit personalities are listening to your prayers. They all turn their ears away because you're not real.
Yeah.
Right? And to God, your prayer is an abomination.
You know, what really helps me is to think of the process. And when you start with the five favorable conditions as like a starting point, loyal, humble, sincere, just, and patient, and then you kind of take it up a notch into coordinating and doing some serious work in terms of the cosmic intuitions, and then hopefully you look above that and you have this spirit of truth, this fourth intuition, and this holistic framework that can somehow have your mind can have access to that domain of truth. There's this sort of this process of building your way into conformity with the cosmos, and the process and being sort of aiming and being striking step with that process, it seems to unfold in time. So without those building blocks and having that process laid out, as Chris has over the years sort of given us those crumbs, things can seem bleak at time. Either you're here or it's binary. You're either not going to make it or you are. But the process has given me a lot of hope and a sort of framework in which I can understand some of these concepts.
It's that initial humble, unlearned child of God's faith grasp is attempt to take a hold of and never let go of the divine law. Right, gets you into the real process. You will be grown, you will eventually fuse, et cetera, but not unless you really begin. Again, like I quoted, right? If you don't eventually spiritualize your loyalty, right, then you will, the energy system of, that you're calling you will be disorganized. Right? And, you have to take a hold of the essence, and then you have to get into the substance, right, so that you can be coordinated with cosmic reality. Otherwise, you'll be destroyed. And because there is only one system predicated on one absolute unchanging law. And it's just, there's all the grace and everything, but it's predicated on your free will choice to be obedient to that fact of the divine law. It's so easy to lose sight of that when we start talking about God's absolute infinite love. It seems like it's impossible to ever have a sentence like when the provisions of endless mercy and nameless patience have been exhausted. Wait a minute, I thought it was absolute and infinite. When the provisions of endless mercy and nameless patience have been exhausted in an effort to win the loyalty and devotion of the will creatures of the realm, justice and righteousness will prevail. I said, well, how can that be if God's love is absolute and infinite? Well, yeah, but your free will is absolute also. You can block his absoluteness, you check his absoluteness, and you block his infinity. Right? So it doesn't matter how absolute and infinite it is. Right? It's exhausted, quote unquote, right? Because you have to choose to open the door of obedience to the divine law. Evil is the measure of the imperfectness of obedience to the Father's will. And that's the tricky thing. That word obedience is like, that sounds like the old God of wrath and stuff. And boy, I'm told that God is love, and I don't have to worry about that obedience thing and all the scariness of the divine law and stuff. That's all taken away. I'm free now to just bask in the love of God. It's like, no, it doesn't work that way. There is no love of God apart from the law of God. Not really. Again to stress this, as we're talking about all of these glorious stages forward in the evolution of a world, now literally the stages of light and life, but remember our arc title, purpose and destiny. It's not our purpose, it's God's purpose. You have to be obedient to God's purpose in order to partake of his destiny for you. That purpose and destiny. The first principle of the Lucifer Manifesto is the nihilistic principle. It's denying that there is purpose.
Yeah.
Yeah. We're trying to challenge that, right? We're now to the paper immediately following the Lucifer Rebellion, talking about purpose and destiny, in the wake of him saying, point number one, that whole God purposing everything, that's just a bunch of baloney. Yeah. So you don't have to worry about somehow conforming to that purposing, figuring it out, right? Spending endless billions of years debauching yourself to this belief. That's what we're trying to get at.
I have one final thought, Chris. You've talked in the past about law and love being two sides of the same coin, and
yeah.
when you're describing obedience to the divine law, I can't help but think of the other side of that coin being conformity with the cosmos and righteousness, because that's sort of my concept frame. Immediately when you say be obedient to the divine law, I immediately say conformity with the cosmos, conformity with the cosmos. That's where my mind goes. And that's
correct. See, when you translate from the existential fact of the divine law to the time and space cosmos, right? We call this agreement righteousness, and which is conformity with the cosmos, right? Taking that existential fact of the divine law and putting it into dynamic time and space existence as a universal harmony called the cosmos.
And that's where the growth is able to take place, through
yeah.
that conformity, the part manifesting the qualities of the individuality of the whole, and the cycle just, it's a circuit.
Yeah, a growth that goes on until you achieve a co-absolute, right, precise, perfect agreement with the divine law.
Okay.
That divine law is unchanged throughout all that growth. You're just growing closer and closer to a direct, precise conformity with it.
Moment
without any translation down through the co-absolute, through the ultimate, down through the absonite, through the supreme, down through the finite to where you are now.
Complete but not replete, right?
Yeah. And the fact that grace threads down through all those levels I just described and allows you to conform precisely to the essence of that all the way down here at this lowly level, so far removed from a direct interface with absoluteness. But still, you can see with all that grace over all that infinite distance, it's still in your free will hands to accept, put yourself in cooperative subordination to, or not.
And that's where a stagnant soul is a dying soul.
Yeah.
Good point.
So just, yeah, all those things, you know, to see the glorious statements about the love of God in their proper context, right? Because the moment that liberty is not in law, you've backed into Lucifer's mind, right? You don't want to have the mind of Lucifer. You want to have the mind of Jesus. But it's very natural to back in, you know, to the mindedness that Lucifer backed into.
It's very natural, and it's very fashionable. Natural is fashionable these days, so, yeah.
And the only reason that Lucifer kind of, you know, got confused like that is because God is love. See, I mean, the fact that God is love makes it appear that, you know, that in many ways, no, there isn't some harsh absolute law that I have to dot every I on. See, you know, love and grace can be confusing to an immature mind like Lucifer's or ours. To just remind yourself that it's the fact of the love of God that got Lucifer off track. Right? If every time he opened his eyes, there was it stark and glaring in his face, right? The divine law. you know, a deep horn blue every time you looked at it. Okay? I mean, you know, he wouldn't have gone off on that. You know, everybody go, oh, okay, yeah, yeah, okay, that's serious. I need to keep that in mind. But, you know, that doesn't happen, right? You know, and so it's easy to get lost in a bliss of self, you know, in the context of the love of God.
It's easy to lose one's perspective, cosmically. I mean, it's hard to gain a cosmic perspective from the bottom up, but that's a whole other topic. I mean, Lucifer had one and then he lost it. So.
Yep.
Interesting.
He had one for billions and billions and billions of years, and then he lost it.
Yeah. Okay, well, should we begin our reading this evening?
Yes, we
Fascinating
should.
Discussion. Yeah, I appreciate all the topics we're touching on. You know, we talk about these things frequently here on Symmetry of Soul, and I know that's quite a bit of airtime, but I really like what was said one time. We keep trying to find the different words to say the same thing over and over so that there's a chance that someone out there listening, that it'll hit them just right. You know, there's just a handful of times over the years on Symmetry of Soul that something has really been phrased just properly, and it really struck me on a deep level and stayed with me. I try to put those moments on our website when I can, but those are really just for me. I mean, we each have to have our own. So that was a discussion we've had before and we'll have again, but it's worth it. I mean, the stakes are as big as they get when it comes to talking about liberty and law in the cosmos. So. Okay, well, we're in paper 55 of the Urantia book, The Spheres of Light and Life, and we're in section 2 tonight, Death and Translation, as promised. Page 623 of the original single-column text. Natural physical death is not a mortal inevitability. The majority of advanced evolutionary beings, citizens on worlds existing in the final era of light and life, do not die. They are translated directly from the life in the flesh to the Morantia existence.
Now, explain more precisely here in a little while at what point you get to the greater than 50% that they're alluding to there, the majority of advanced evolutionary beings. Yeah, so there's that little technical detail. And then there's also the between-the-lines technical detail of, you know, when they say natural physical death is not a mortal inevitability, don't skip the natural comma part of that sentence. You can't avoid the death of your mortal self. It's by definition mortal. It dies one way or another, either dies naturally or unnaturally, like in fusion. Right? If your soul fuses with your thought adjuster, your mortal self dies. Right? There's physical death of that mortal self. It's just an unnatural physical death. Right?
Yeah,
What doesn't experience a downtime, you know, a deanimated period, is your Morantia self. Right? Seated on your soul, that mindal self, right? You know, doesn't skip a beat. You know, right now my Morantia mindal self is, you know, is awake and active. If I were to fuse, you know, it would never, quote-unquote, close its eyes. It would just keep right on going. But I'm going to die a natural physical death. Right? And so not only is that the end of my adjutant mortal self, but my Morantia self that will eventually be resurrected in the first mansion world, quote-unquote, closes its eyes for a while. Right? It's not animate for some span of time. Yeah, there's a death translation process there for it.
It's on ice for a while. Yeah.
So again, let's make sure that we remember that we're not talking about some magic that makes a mortal self immortal. No, mortal selves are mortal. Period. The Universal Father himself cannot make a mortal self not die. It's mortal.
That's making square circles. It's not logical.
Yes, making square circles.
Yeah.
Yes. All right. But you have a potentially immortal self right now that doesn't, doesn't have that hard limit set into it.
Yeah. All right. Technical point. Last week we talked about spirit fusers on Worlds of Spirit Fusion, where they continue to experience natural physical death always.
Mm-hmm.
Does this paragraph suggest that they are not advanced evolutionary beings, or do we just need to take this paragraph in its proper context? They're speaking to adjuster fusion type worlds because of the section we're in.
Right. They reminded you of that little, asterisk, up front in this paper. But meanwhile, back to, speaking to you, who aren't spirit fusers. You have to just kind of keep that in mind. They're not going to repeat it every other paragraph to, don't forget, it's just, that fact that, we're talking about, we're obviously talking about fusion with adjusters, so,
right.
Okay, that's, we're speaking to the side of spirit fusers.
Of course. Yeah, just a reminder that sometimes, just a reminder that this book is written for humans to read, not machines to read. It's up to you to avoid more or less distortion of meaning. That's an easy one there.
you want to strive for less, and that more will come naturally. The degree to which you can be unnatural in your engagement, that will be less distortion of meaning.
There you go. This experience of translation from the material life to the Marantia state, fusion of the immortal soul with the indwelling adjuster, increases in frequency commensurate with the evolutionary progress of the planet. At first, only a few mortals in each age attain translation levels of spiritual progress, but with the onset of the successive ages of teacher sons, more and more adjuster fusions occur before the termination of the lengthening lives of these progressing mortals. And by the time of the terminal mission of the teacher sons, approximately one quarter of these superb mortals are exempt from natural death.
So they've given you a hint there already. So we're still a long ways from majority in general when you get to light and life. Approximately 25%. Notice how they were wanting to be very precise there in that opening statement. The translation from the material life to the Marantia state. They didn't say Marantia life because there's no Marantia body, right? To speak in full terms about your Marantia life. This is just your Marantia brain, as it were, right? That soul fusing with the adjuster. You've got to still go get, endowed with a Marantia body that they build for you on whatever Marantia world you're going to start out on.
Right.
Yeah. So just, you can see them, just kind of reminding you there with precision of language, what the translation is. It isn't directly from one life to the next. There's you've got some process yet there until you have a full Marantia body and hence, an outer life, predicated on that body, and and a separation within of an inner life relative to that outer life. See, so this is just sort of a Maharaja state.
They don't speak anywhere else about any kind of delay once, you know, once the fusion and the fusion has occurred and they're at the mansion world resurrection chambers. They don't talk about any delay. It's probably pretty immediate.
Yeah, we'll get
fusion.
That here in just a little bit, you know, and they yeah. kind of speak more immediately to that issue. It's like, well, okay, what about after fusion? Then what? We're just kind of getting to that moment of fusion.
Farther along in the era of light and life, the midway creatures or their associates sense the approaching status of probable soul adjuster union and signify this to the destiny guardians, who in turn communicate these matters to the finaliter group under whose jurisdiction this mortal may be functioning. Then there is issued the summons of the planetary sovereign for such a mortal to resign all planetary duties, bid farewell to the world of his origin, and repair to the inner temple of the planetary sovereign, there to await Maharaja transit, the translation flash, from the material domain of evolution to the Maharaja level of pre-spirit progression.
Okay, so remember how we ended up broadcast last week with that comment about beings getting lifted up into the atmosphere a lot of times. Elevated by the midway creatures and the physical controllers, it said.
Right.
And it's like, well, okay, obviously the midway creatures know about it. So when they say farther along in the era of light and life, the midway creatures or their associates sense the approaching status, like, well, wait a minute, I'm confused. They obviously were sensing the approaching status before. What do they mean here? Here's another example of how you need to, you can't be very mechanical when you're, interpreting things here.
Yeah.
You can see from the rest of the paragraph, they mean, they sense it way in advance, in relative terms, right? So that there's time for all these details and not, oh, my goodness, we've got 5 minutes. Get him up there quick. Forget about relatives or anything like that. Don't inform his boss, that he's leaving. They're pointing out that when you get to these more advanced states, as a mortal, you're a much more refined instrument. It's obvious to the midway creatures, well in advance that you're approaching that.
Yeah. Well, it seems like the midway creatures would have been learning as well. A couple million years to figure all this out, they might become much better discerners of the steps of candidacy, and they could see it with more easily.
There's certainly that too. Yeah, the thing you notice there as well is, or their associates. Now, obviously, there could be beings that aren't revealed and whatnot. But your first thought goes to the unrevealed, lower order of angels.
Oh, sure.
Which are, sort of in a vertical sense, at the same level as the midway creatures, secondary midway creatures specifically. So it's probably that lesser order of angels. That'd be my first guess anyway, right? That they too can pick up on this. And again, notice it's in they have to inform the destiny guardians. See, so, that reminds you of what the physics is here. It's not something that, the guardian angels, the seraphim are going to pick up kind of at a higher level in, monitoring the individual, the mortal. It's something, the lights are going off down at a lower, more physical level where these lower beings, notice something.
So, Chris, you're referencing the statement when they say it would almost be a betrayal of trust because they're so close to you?
Yeah, that and the two other times that they refer to that lower order of angels, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, and I'm seeing maybe, you know, here is yet another one. It's a guesstimate here, though. It isn't so definitive as the other three times where they're very directly telling you there's this lower order of angels. There has to be.
It doesn't. I just did some rough math. I mean, I think here on Earth today, about 180,000 people die every day. If 25% of them translated every day, that's 45,000, which is basically, you know, in a normal world, most of the midwayers. This is all they would be occupied with doing. On our world,
yeah.
We have far less than the full complement. So there has to be huge delegation to these associates.
Right, exactly. Right. There's only, almost all the time when people are talking about things, they say, oh, I think the midwayers, blah, blah, blah. It's like, no, think about how few eyeballs and hands there are that are midwayers.
Yeah.
It's that lower order of angels that are doing most of the material stuff, if there's something materially related going on. It's not the midwayers. There's just, a handful of them. Yeah, you got to keep the numbers of the midwayers in mind, which people don't tend to do when they flippantly talk about midwayers doing this, that, and the other thing.
But that is curious. You would suspect that Destiny Guardians would have a real keen perception as to the spiritual readiness of their protectees
to when they might
be translating.
And they know that they're working on that final kind of, if you want to say post-first circular synchronization with the adjuster process. The Guardians, the Destiny Guardians know that. But they don't, there's no way they can sense a timing, with that. But these lower beings are looking at it more from a physical standpoint. They can go, that process is going to unravel this guy's atoms. I can see his atoms starting to swell. There's a couple cracks in a couple of them.
He's getting ready to blow, Captain. Is that what's happening?
That's what they're picking up on, see. Or as Brad was saying, I think there's some mortar that just fell out between those two bricks there.
I can't help but think of Jesus before he puts his tools down and says, my hour has come, and walks to go to baptism. Can't help but think of the midwayers sensing this moment arriving and being there and being like, oh, I'm sensing some, his hour's almost come. His hour's almost come.
Right, so is it that again? It's this part of this process that we tend not to think about, but because we're all so focused on the, as they say, their soul hyphen adjuster union. But there's this body and that mortal self and all that. That is on the verge of being disassembled. And it has tells. That the less temporally related spiritual stuff that the Destiny Guardians are looking at don't have. Right? You don't see approaching fusion when you're looking at your more eternity-like aspects. But if you look at the very temporal, mortal self, temporal parts, you can see it.
I've never thought of it in terms of you're kind of talking like fruit ripening or something, like there's a process going on.
Yep.
That is not within the decision realm of the administrators or the caretakers or whatever, that there's a natural process unfolding that needs to be recognized and accommodated.
Yeah,
rather than
this would
initiated.
Be divine law, right? Showing its hand. So, you know, there's just laws of spirit, mind, and matter, period. And they're playing out. Okay, so anyway, now they're pointing out that, you know, as they're saying, farther along in the era of light and life, there can be quite a, you know, a big build-up to this, right? That, and that's sort of what the temple is, you know, eventually there to be, is this the place where all of this can come to this very organized, finale.
I have a little fun fact really quick. The last paragraph of Section 1, when it talks about material body of translation candidates elevated by the midwayer creatures and the physical controllers, on our world, since we had 500,000 years before the planetary prince arrived, technically no one in that initial 500,000-year period could have been carried up to the atmosphere because midwayers weren't there. So if someone views in that state, things would have gone really haywire.
Yeah. You're reminded of, you know, how the precision of that sentence. These fusion flashes many times occur in the planetary atmosphere. So not every time, right? You know, if you've got a wasteland somewhere, that'll work fine too.
Almagordo will work.
Maybe there's some excess ice that needs to be melted, and the fusion over there.
Tunguska, I'm telling you.
One other thing that is just sort of makes me smile is the strict chain of command that they announce here that the midway creatures sense it. They go to the Destiny Guardians, who go to the finaliters of the group under whose jurisdiction the mortal is functioning, and then the summons of the planetary sovereign. So it's a very well ordered chain of command here.
It's almost like the divine law is absolute. So it casts a shadow of a universal order. Yeah. When you see the order, that's how you know that, you know, invisibly behind all that, there is the divine law. Right? Where else would that order come from? So, don't take order for granted, and at the same time recognize that, you know, that's what conformity to the divine law will look like, right? There will be order, order in your life. It appears that it's going to be wonderful if you exercise your liberty outside of law, but no, anarchy, and the lack of order will not be as pleasing as you initially imagined. Okay, so now they're going to give us more of this. So now that we have time for all kinds of logistics, we can build up this big to-do.
When the family, friends, and working group of such a fusion candidate have foregathered in the Morantia Temple, they are distributed around the central stage whereon the fusion candidates are resting, meantime freely conversing with their assembled friends. A circle of intervening celestial personalities is arranged to protect the material mortals from the action of the energies manifest at the instant of the life flash, which delivers the ascension candidate from the bonds of material flesh, thereby doing for such an evolutionary mortal everything that natural death does for those who are thereby delivered from the flesh.
Yeah. First thing to note is it kills you. Just like natural death. And they say everything that natural death does, right? Okay. First, zeroth order detail is it kills you. You know, but at the same time, you know, allowing for both the adjuster and your soul, you know, to be a part. You know, remember, neither the adjuster nor your Marantia self right now, that based on your soul, are personalized. And the personality is identified to your adjutant, mortal self. You know, but you know the adjuster and the and your soul are relative to that personalized adjutant self, and so they need to be, you know, as it were, sort of bungee corded to you. Right? I mean, even when you have a self-acting adjuster, right, there's still a bungee cord on it, right? It comes back.
I suppose that's a fair statement.
Yeah, right. I mean, it's, you know, so, but once that mortal self is gone, you know, and that personality is not identified, okay, now, you know, in just, you know, an entity fashion, you know, rather than a being fashion, right, the adjuster and the soul fused to it, right, it can exist apart from that. Eventually, when you get the body, personality is going to identify again, and you'll be back to a being instead of just this transitional entity phenomenon.
I'm wondering about these candidates resting and freely conversing. I'm wondering about the distances involved. I see couches myself. I see them reclining. But I'm seeing them have to yell across a fairly great distance to talk to their friends.
Yeah. How many couches do they vaporize in this process?
I know.
Lounge chairs or something. But, yeah, and we mentioned before, you know, these you know, unrevealed intervening celestial personalities, whatever they are, okay, so they're obviously, they need to protect the material mortals. But, you know, one can wonder, so they're also going to be channeling all this energy, you know, up. You know, it probably helps, you know, from ringing the bell of the Marantia's, you know, stadium too hard, too.
These are the asbestonites. That's who they are.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh my.
Celestial asbestos beings, yes. It's just, you know, it's just fascinating to imagine what this actually looks like, you know, and they have to be careful, you know, to not have, you know, celestial beings, you know, fly through that beam, you know, when it goes off, or, you know, it's like a planetary defense system. It's just kind of fascinating to think about the literalness of these fusion flashes.
Exactly. We did that last week, too, to great amusement.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, yeah. There's a lot of, you know, birds flying overhead that, you know, whoops, where did they go? Yeah, so much for that flock of geese. All right.
Justin, would you like to take the reading from here?
Sure, thanks, Brad. Many fusion candidates may be assembled in the spacious temple at the same time. And what a beautiful occasion when mortals thus foregather to witness the ascension of their loved ones in spiritual flames. And what a contrast to those earlier ages when mortals must commit their dead to the embrace of the terrestrial elements. The scenes of weeping and wailing characteristic of earlier epochs of human evolution are now replaced by ecstatic joy and sublimest enthusiasm as these God-knowing mortals bid their loved ones in transit farewell as they are removed from their material associations by the spiritual fires of consuming grandeur and ascending glory. On worlds settled in light and life, funerals are occasions of supreme joy, profound satisfaction, and inexpressible hope.
Okay. So, one point, notice that they got in that technical detail of these God-knowing mortals. Now, we're in light and life here. Yeah, so we're, yeah, it's just a given that you not only have mortals who have been born again, but mortals who have been born again.
Mm-hmm.
Right, they're spirit-born and God-knowing. Speak in very general terms. And it's like, you know, and some of whom are God-knowing. No, you know, these God-knowing mortals. So just reminding you of how, you know, not merely, you know, a bottom-up religionist born again, but, you know, a full predicated on eternity. Right? Like we talked about, that eternity predicate is, you know, it goes hand-in-hand with the long lifespans. Right? An eternalized mind, more eternalized mind as a body that lives longer,
right?
Et cetera, right? All those, you know, just that. But the interesting thing, see, and we can't say much because the physics is so confusing. But you know, see, they definitely make a point of an immediate sense of talking about spiritual flames, spiritual fires. Is interesting.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Twice.
Yeah. So they, you know, they're talking about, you know, obviously, you know, the immediacy of the energy phenomenon, you know, of the soul, you know, with its, you know, woven in spiritual nature, you know, engaging this, you know, this quote unquote spirit fragment that is the adjuster. Yeah, so that the immediacy of that, of the spiritual fires there, but the fact that it's a triune energy system, and yeah, you know, so you know, there isn't in the context of God, you know, Mother Deity. I mean, these, you know, matter, mind, and spirit aren't, you know, just absolutely separated and end of story. Right? There's an interplay in the triune system, and and we've got this, as you pointed out, Justin, this literal deity, you know, stuff of the adjuster that's present in this context.
Pure,
you know,
spirit.
Where matter, mind, and spirit are kind of transcendently together as one stuff.
Yeah.
And so how does this physics all work, you know, and how much of the energy flash that you've got to protect people from and whatnot, you know, is predicated on the pure energy part of the adjuster, kind of, you know, sort of rebounding off of it, you know, or, I mean, it's hard to know how to speculate about it, you know, and what to point at as a, you know, as kind of the primary causal element, but it is interesting that they seem to, you know, not just talk about physical. Yeah, fires, physical flames, but spiritual. You know, and so this is an interesting, you know, vague, tantalizing clues that they're giving.
Yeah.
The souls of these progressing mortals are increasingly filled with faith, hope, and assurance. The spirit permeating those gathered around the translation shrine resemble that of the joyful friends and relatives who might assemble at a graduating exercise for one of their group, or who might come together to witness the conferring of some great honor upon one of their number. And it would be decidedly helpful if less advanced mortals could only learn to view natural death with something of this same cheerfulness and lightheartedness.
Wait a minute. I think they just called me less advanced mortal.
What's the hard sell?
I can't help but the first sentence, this triplet of faith, hope, and assurance, I can't help but think of the similarity, and I believe it's the preface of 101, where it talks about religion is faith, trust, and assurance.
You knew where I was going to go, yes. Right. Notice the way they're wording that. The souls, remember, you kind of have soul trust. The souls of these progressing mortals are increasingly filled. So giving you the picture of a spirit-filled soul, as it were.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And so in terms of the triplet, instead of saying, you know, in the kind of the fullness of faith, trust, assurance, right, they replaced trust with the spiritual essence
hope.
Of trust, hope. Yeah. See, so it's more directly the spirit essence of that triplet. Yeah, it would be the spirit essence of the assurance, too, instead of the full trust-predicated assurance. But, you know, playing off of that, right? See, again, in these precise scientific ways, right, to get you to think as much about the law of God as the love of God. Did you have, you know, literal sequences. It's, you know, the order is faith, trust, assurance, and then you can talk about the spiritual essence of that trust as hope, and right, that kind of stuff that, you know, in a mystical fog predicated on some notion of the love of God, you just don't have. Right? You know, so just saying religion is, right, remember the italics there? Religion is faith, trust, and assurance. See, I mean, it has this order, this law-predicated nature to it.
Mm-hmm.
Right? It doesn't just say, religion is joy, or something, right? Which ends up being religion is, in quotes, and it's, you know, self-satisfaction, right? Masquerading as religion. So, yeah, just it's always there, right? Every time I point out the physics of something, I'm reminding of everyone of, don't forget, there's the divine law as well as the divine love. There's order, immutable order in everything. And you're commanded to get into ever more precise identification with that order. Again, in that passage, I was referring to when they speak of individuals that are not focusing as they should. They don't shy away from some very direct statements. If man will not listen to the gods as they speak to their creation in the laws of spirit, mind, and matter, I mean, just think about that sentence, you know, the beginning of that sentence, right? That the voice that you're looking for are the laws of spirit, mind, and matter. If you won't listen to that, the very act of such deliberate and conscious disdain by the creature turns the ears of spirit personalities away from hearing the personal petitions of such lawless and disobedient mortals. It's just,
and on
see
a basic,
how important the order is, the law, the structure?
On the most fundamental, basic level, Chris, that's giving form to figment in your mind as opposed to fact, correct? I mean, it's that simple.
Yeah.
On the most basic level, it's
yeah.
If
the
you
universe
choose to
does not honor your definitive consecration to figment.
Yeah.
Right? No matter how earnest you are, right? When all is said and done, right? You know, the gods speak in the laws of the three energies, including matter, right? And that's, you know, statements like that are just not where people tend to begin, you know, in looking for the voice of God. Now, like, well, I like to believe that I'm, you know, if I jump off a cliff, you know, I don't fall because I'm really spiritual. I can levitate. See, I mean, you're already, you know, leaving God's domain in your mind when you start to think like that. You know, you're not putting your mind in obedience to material law.
Or reality.
Yeah, which takes you to reality, exactly. So, you know, that's just to, you know, I don't want to keep, you know, pounding on that. But again, it's inescapable. Almost every paragraph in the book has some sort of little precise law tied, you know, scientific statement, if you will, in it. Right? It's got all this precision to it. You know, they talk about God's love in very precise ways.
Yeah, I suppose they do. It's, you know, you can fuzz out over all the words, but we're here trying not to.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I know you get, you know, how did they describe that? They used the word sublime. What did they say? What we just read there.
Sublimest enthusiasm.
Yeah.
Ecstatic joy and the sublimest enthusiasm.
Right. I mean, I know everyone has that sense, you know, predicated on an imagining of the love of God. The sublimity is there. Right? But, you know, it's the precision there. Right? So that's why I always emphasize as we go through every time. It's like, okay, notice this little precise thing here. Notice that they have the words in this order instead of that order. And why do I do that? I'm just trying to make sure we don't lose sight of the law as we're talking about the law. All right.
Mortal observers can see nothing of their translated associates subsequent to the fusion flash. Such translated souls proceed by adjuster transit directly to the resurrection hall of the appropriate Marantia training world. These transactions concerned with the translation of living human beings to the Marantia world are supervised by an archangel who was assigned to such a world on the day when it was first settled in light and life.
Well, do you know what it means to actually have a divisional headquarters of the archangels here?
Right. We got those guys already.
They're assigned here already.
We're ready.
Not just one of them. So that's an interesting
circuit.
Sidelight to that. And remember, the first time the archangel circuit operated was, to kind of do the details with the dispensational resurrection, right, on Easter Sunday, as we call it. 2,000 years ago. So not only is there that headquarters, they're stationed here, but they've got a circuit because their stationing here is transcendent of the rebellion. Right. You've got a measure of that which is above the cutting off of the circuits, brought down in the midst of that. Okay, so there's that, and then this whole bit of adjuster transit. Okay. If we had more time tonight, we could even read the whole thing at the end of paper 49 about the primary modified order of ascension. But, you know, if people want to go there at some point, look, you'll notice that they also use that expression, adjuster transit, in that description. You know, and they've referred to the primary modified order of ascension already, you know, as we've been reading here. And this direct adjuster transit, you know, it's you know, you were bringing that up, Kermit. And when you don't have a Marantia body yet, okay, you know, you don't have to in seraphim and putz along at, you know, just under three times the speed of light. Right, this soul that's fused to this adjuster, okay, I mean, it, you know, with no, in, you know, taking no time, goes from the nativity sphere where the fusion occurred to its destination, even all the way to Salvington. You know, that process of traversing space freely, as they say, right? They purposely say traverse. You know, think of the verse part, the turn. I mean, you're not going to go through the space over some span of time. Think of a rotation. You know, like if you lay your forearm down on a table, you know, and then pivot up on, you know, with your elbow. You know, your fist is on the table on one side, and then it's on the other side, and it doesn't go, you know, touch any of the points of the table in between those two points. It rotates, right, from one point to the next. I mean, think about that instantaneous, you know, soul adjuster union, you know, going from point A to point B, see, transcendent of the space between point A and point B. And so it takes no time.
It's difficult, Chris, because I've spent so much time, you know, just conditioning myself to deal with the three times the speed of light speed limit in the universe. And now I'm like, oh, yeah, except when there's not. And I'm like, well, wait, what? So are there or aren't there rules? I mean, of course there are. Of course there are.
Yeah.
But it's, yeah.
But here's, see, I told you, we would see another example. I see, you know, you go, well, wait a minute. This is, there's a Marantia soul. I mean, I thought that had to be transported by a transport
right.
angel.
But this is where this is
the
pure energy.
This is a very transcendent kind of Marantia stuff. It can literally be glued to this adjuster and go from point A to point B at infinite speed, effective infinite speed.
There's no drag.
Yeah.
But,
see, it's
but,
not kind of dragging down in space, you know, like, you know.
But only
so,
this one time, only this initial,
yeah,
because
one,
you have to be in seraphim and do all these other transports
yeah,
way
yeah.
after this. Is
once you get there
spirit.
And they put a body on you, okay, now you're going to, every time you're going to have to use a transport angel. Yeah.
Right. Huh. Curious.
Yeah, so just, yeah, see, that's how mysterious, you know, secrets of ascending and this Marantia stuff is of this soul. It's like, wait a minute, it doesn't have to be seraphimed? What? You can see how much sort of adjuster-like it is. Instead of master physical controller, Marantia power supervisor, artificial construct-like.
Yeah, lanes of energy, et cetera.
Yeah. It's something quite transcendent. Despite all appearances to the contrary. I mean, you know, beings can look and it's like, well, it looks like Marantia stuff to me. Right? And then it does something like this. It's like, well, okay, wait a minute. How does that work?
It makes you wonder, in line with Brad's question, is there anything else in the cosmos that adjusters, when they say adjuster transit, do they carry anything but the soul in that same capacity of instantaneous arrival? Is this the only object where that is applicable because they're weaving themselves into the object?
Yeah. 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 It's not like their luggage is fused to them like this.
Yeah.
That can still go to another city just like your luggage.
By the time a world attains the fourth stage of light and life, more than half the mortals leave the planet by translation from among the living. Such diminishment of death continues on and on, but I know of no system whose inhabited worlds even though long settled in life, are entirely free from natural death as the technique of escape from the bonds of flesh. And until such a high state of planetary evolution is uniformly attained, the Marantia training worlds of the local universe must continue in service as educational and cultural spheres for the evolving Marantia progressors. The elimination of death is theoretically possible, but it has not yet occurred according to my observation. Perhaps such a status may be attained during the faraway stretches of the succeeding epochs of the seventh stage of settled planetary life.
Again, the elimination of natural death is theoretically possible. I mean, there's still mortal selves. And it doesn't matter how deep we go in the seventh stage of light and life, the adjutant self is killed by the fusion flash, right, and dies. So just, you know, don't get magical about when they say it, you know, in such shorthand like that. But here we see, okay, you get the fourth stage of light and life, and, you know, you can get past the 50% point, like they were alluding to in the opening paragraph. See, so, you know, 4, 5, 6, 7, you know, like they said in those, how did they describe that? The final era of light and life, as they said there. But, you know, the other thing to keep in mind here is that, you know, we saw it was only 25% at the beginning of light and life. Here we're finally, you know, this is so far beyond our imagining now. You know, we're just getting to past 50%. You know, flip all that, you know, back around to yourself, right, and as a source of humility. You know, this whole wishful thinking of, oh, I'm going to fuse. Hey, I mean, yeah, beginning of light and life, you know, they wouldn't even let you breathe on their planet. Okay, and only 25% of them are fusing. I mean, that's how far from this we are. There's even more amazing statements to come in this regard, more humbling statements. You know, not only about fusion, but about, you know, the psychic circles themselves. And it's like, well, I'm pretty sure I'm a first circler, at least a third circler. You know, be thankful that you're a seventh circler by grace, and just, let's just start there.
Right.
Yeah. Because, you know, the advanced quality that we're actually talking about is mostly unimaginable to us, let alone being incomprehensible. So let's just humbly, you know, take it one step at a time here.
Well, Kermit, would you like to take over the reading from here?
Sure, thanks. I'll do that. The translated souls of the flowering ages of the settled spheres do not pass through the mansion worlds. Neither do they sojourn as students on the Marantia worlds of the system or constellation. They do not pass through any of the earlier phases of Marantia life. They are the only ascending mortals who so nearly escape the Marantia transition from material existence to semi-spirit status. The initial experience of such sun-seized mortals in the ascension career is in the services of the progression worlds of the universe headquarters. And from these study worlds of Salvington, they go back as teachers to the very worlds they pass by, subsequently going on inward to paradise by the established route of mortal ascension.
So here they are again, reminding you of what they said, you know, a few papers prior there at the end of paper 49 about the mortals of the primary modified order of ascension, those that are quote-unquote sun-seized like that. You know, so that instantaneous, you know, as they say there, you know, the soul adjuster union appears immediately in the presence of the Sovereign Son. All right? So, you rotate transcendence, as it were, right, of time and space, and immediately you're at point B, you know, having left point A, no matter how many light years away that is.
So that's what they mean by sun seized. You're seized by the Creator Sun immediately,
yeah, the
brought
what's
up.
What's literally
to Salvington.
Seizing you, right, is his spirit gravity. Remember, he's a local node of spirit gravity because of his parentage with the absolute node of spirit gravity, the Eternal Sun.
And it even says in 49. That they immediately appear in the presence of the Sovereign
yes.
Son.
Yeah.
So talk about gravity. You're literally going to the source.
Yes. Yes. Now you're going to the node. His local node really kind of masks the transcendent one of the Eternal Son himself. Right? And you really only begin to become aware of that once you leave the local universe and have transcended that local nuclear point for spirit gravity.
Right.
Right. So, yeah, so you were seized. Remember, that's where we're really thinking of the spirit aspect of that soul and the spirit fragment, you know, aspect of the adjuster, right, in spirit gravity, and it seizes that.
Okay. Could you but visit a planet in the advanced stage of development, you would quickly grasp the reasons for providing for the differential reception of ascending mortals on the mansions and higher Marantia worlds. You would readily understand that beings passing on from such highly evolved spheres are prepared to resume their paradise ascent far in advance of the average mortal arriving from a disordered and backward world like Urantia.
There they go
Thanks
again.
Thanks very much.
Yeah, present company accepted, of course.
Sorry, for a moment I had forgotten. Yeah, thank you for reminding me.
We've already stressed this a number of times. You know, starting kind of way back when we were in the post-magisterial sun age, ever since. Yeah, here they are just reminding us again. I mean, you can't imagine, you know, the quality differential between these beings we're talking about and ourselves. I mean, they are so advanced relative to us. I mean, like these ones we're talking about that are sun seeds. I mean, they literally, on their nativity sphere, have gotten the essence of everything all the way up through the local system and the constellation.
Yeah. Yeah,
I mean, all of that cosmic socialization at the constellation level, that's happening on their nativity sphere, you know, in large part.
Yeah.
It's so beyond a world that we can imagine.
Mind-boggling.
You know, what's the most mind-boggling, the thing that stands out the most to me about that is when you think about the sheer processing power of mind when it's attuned to this protoplasm blob, as you often say, Chris, in terms of our brain. Our brains are limited in terms of processing power. Just the sheer natural physical body itself limits what mind can do. And when you go to this Marantia state, I think of mind and what it's capable of doing in that type of body, and I'm like, whoa, okay, there's a huge differential of how the processing power of mind itself. And to think that these humans that are only living to be 500 years, even though it's this refined combination of matter, mind, and spirit in ways that we can't comprehend, it's still limited to material brain, you know? The mind itself is stuck in that hardware. And so it's fascinating that so much can be achieved in such lowly hardware, I guess, is what I'm getting at.
Right. I mean, it's reminding you of, you know, when we think of the hourglass analogy, you know, don't make that hourglass, you know, very squat. Right? There's a lot of vertical extent possible. You can get your mind functioning well above the boat anchor. You know, even if you can't yet sever yourself from the boat anchor of the blob of protoplasm like you're talking about.
Hmm.
Right? Take delight in cultivating. Try it out. You'll be amazed at how much transcendent you can get of your lowly animal origin, even in this life, with feet of clay still. Try it. You'll be amazed. You know, at just how nonlinear, synthetic, objective your mind can function. You know, if you just consecrate yourself upward.
Right? It's fascinating that the ceiling point is that high. It's fascinating.
When you're born again, it goes from material to spiritual, human to divine, time to eternity. Right? Those are different. You predicate, you know, on the second one of each of those three. Right? It's a very transcendent mind functioning. Try it.
Yeah. No matter from what level of planetary attainment human beings may ascend to the Marantia worlds, the seven mentioned spheres afford them ample opportunity to gain and experience as teacher students all of everything which they failed to pass through because of the advanced status of their native planets.
Right, so they got this essence, but they still need to go back, you know, as teacher students, because as they're about to mention in the final little paragraph, you need to embody, the entire range from bottom to top to be a finaliter. That's what a finaliter is. It's someone that embodies that entire range.
Yeah.
You can't really skip over a chunk, or you couldn't become a finaliter.
Right. Right.
But the physics of your nature, you know, you fuse and you sun seize, and okay, yeah, that's, you know, can't be changed. That's just a law of the energies that's what happens. Right. But the evolutionary experience, right, you need to just artificially add in. So go ahead and read that final little statement.
The universe is unfailing in the application of these equalizing techniques designed to ensure that no ascender shall be deprived of aught which is essential to his ascension experience.
And again, see, like I was saying, you know, essential, right, when we're talking about, you know, an adjuster-fused future finaliter, right, that's what they are.
Right.
Someone who is not deprived of aught.
Right.
It does lead to some pretty curious edge cases, like, oh, congratulations, you fused and you showed up directly on Salvington, but you didn't have kids, so back to the nursery with you, diaper duty. I mean, that appears
you need
to be
a bottle for the material sons and daughters on Jerusalem.
what a big cosmos this is. Goodness.
Yeah, and again, just all of that order and everything, you know, see, the unfailing, see, in the application,
mm-hmm.
because they all, you know, are unfailingly identified with the divine law, the absolute unchanging divine law. You can see, like I said, you can see it everywhere. It's always there in everything you're reading. If you just look for it.
That's a fascinating theme to bring in this evening, Chris. I know we bring it up often, but to thread this notion of divine law throughout our study this evening and in material that, like we said at the beginning, could seem a little abstract. What does a sphere of light and life have to do with me? What's a Marantia temple have to do with me? Well, you know, this is how we try to study the Urantia book. This is the kind of study you model for us, and we do our best to to pattern ourselves after that model. So hope it was illuminating for everyone out there. Please come back next Tuesday. We'll continue on in Paper 55 then. Until then, follow the way.
Take care, everyone.
God bless all.
Yes, God bless everyone. We will jump into that idea of much wishful thinking, the golden ages, next time. See where they take us with that. Very interesting what they do. So tune in next week. Take care, everyone. Bye now.